Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Welcome to the Cognitive Recalibration Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Shravan. We've got Tarun here with us.
Hello.
And we're joined by special guest, returning guest. Always fun to have him on the podcast. Bhaskar, welcome back.
Hello, nice to be back.
Thanks. And we are talking the big bet that you two had is gonna be revealed who wins that bet today.
Almost forgot that bet. We should have maybe had a cutoff. I didn't even check the results.
Yeah.
So is there results? Yeah.
There is results. I've got multiple sources as well. So I've got IMDb, Rotten Tomatoes.
Oh, Shravan did his research on this one.
Metacritic. We've got all of them together. So
if there's a sock in that bin, I already know what's going on.
Well, Remy will be ready to eat any socks. So
he tried to eat our socks prior to the results.
Yeah, when
prior
we had
to
them
jump
on.
The gun.
Yeah. When we had them on as well. So.
Yeah.
I'm just very glad I didn't make the condition the box office, because I'd be eating like more than one sock right now.
Christopher Nolan movies don't do great box office. Yeah. Other than Batman. Like
The Dark Knight and Dark Knight Rises both did over $1 billion.
Yep.
But
other
since
than that,
then,
it's like 800, like around that region. And Tenet was worse.
Tenet was less because of COVID. But then, I think Dunkirk was like 6 or 5 or 6.
But like war movies tend to not do that well anyway either. Yeah.
That's nuts.
Yeah. I think his last highest grossing one was Interstellar. And then before that, it would have been Inception.
Dark Knight Rises.
Hmm.
Well, yeah, excluding the Dark Knight. Yeah. So it would have been Inception. But yeah, we'll go through, we'll do the bet at the end. So we'll get to that right after we express our thoughts on both the movies. So
nice concluding point to finish on.
What we'll do actually before we get into our thoughts on the movies is just talk about this phenomenon of Barbenheimer.
Oh, Barbenheimer.
So we watched opening weekend. We did Oppenheimer first and then Barbie, not on the same day.
Yep.
I think that would be quite difficult, actually.
That'd be a very intense experience.
To do it both in the same day, just because Oppenheimer's 3 hours and then Barbie's like 2 hours. But
yeah, we did Oppenheimer on the Friday.
We did Barbie on Saturday.
Sunday. We had a day between. Yeah,
we had a day in between.
I'm glad we did. Because otherwise it would have been too crazy.
Yeah, you would have just been too tired, I think.
Yeah. But box office wise, so both of these movies combined is the highest opening weekend since Avengers Endgame.
That's crazy.
Which is the highest opening weekend ever in history.
Wow.
So it's done extremely well, and it's become a bit of a cultural like phenomenon. Like everyone needs to watch both of these movies. It feels like it's a thing that people do.
But it's really funny because in the beginning, in the very early stages, I remember in this podcast, you guys were both talking about it and it was like it wasn't a thing. It wasn't Barbenheimer. It was like this. It's kind of weird that they're releasing two films that are so
different
at the same time, and we thought one's going to eat the other. Like what happened to Mission Impossible? Essentially.
Yeah, well, that's the
Both ate Mission Impossible.
They both ate Mission Impossible.
That was the collateral damage of this success is
Tom Cruise.
Yeah.
He died. No, he's not. He's still well.
Yeah.
Not truly alive.
He's got Scientology to like.
Yeah, to fuel him. Yeah.
To revive him.
But yeah, like the Mission Impossible, we reviewed it. It was a good movie. We thought it was a pretty good movie. One of the best Mission Impossible movies, but unfortunately it came out the week before these two and it was just completely forgotten.
I don't think people have watched it. Yeah.
Yeah. And we talked about the IMAX thing, how Tom Cruise missed out on all the IMAX screens, but I don't think it was Oppenheimer that killed. We spoke about this off podcast.
It was Meg 2.
It was the Meg 2. No. it was Barbie that I think ultimately killed Mission Impossible, because He lost the IMAX screens, but he would have had a lot of the other screens, which, you know, the non-IMAX screens. But all of those screens were taken up by Barbie because of the phenomenal success of Barbie. Eventually, that sort of led to Mission Impossible not having much of an audience because everyone was going to watch either of these two.
Well, like look at Oppenheimer, which is almost exclusively on, or was made for IMAX. You try and make a booking, it's booked out for the next 2 months.
Yeah.
And it was like upon release. We tried to find a booking in like mid-August.
Yeah.
Back in July. And I'm like, it's all sold out. That the box office record for IMAX is not greater just because people are paying like $38 a ticket.
Yeah.
It's because the IMAX theaters are so few, they're eclipsed by all the other regular theaters. So yeah, if anything pushed it out, it was definitely Barbie because that.
Yeah.
You can still go see Mission Impossible. It's just I think the fact that people are also kind of budgeting what movies they want to see.
That's right.
So I was like, I've got to catch Barbie and maybe I'll catch Oppenheimer and that's it. I'm done for like the whole mid-year cinema fest.
I think it's good. I think they're going to swallow everything around it. Like no one's going to watch anything around Barbie and Oppenheimer for like the next month.
And there's no big releases. And a lot of the releases have actually postponed their release.
For a couple. Well, there's a writer strike and stuff going on.
Yeah, a couple of reasons.
Which, for strike, still going on.
The strike, and then so Gran Turismo, which we were going to watch last weekend.
Oh, they've pushed that back now. Well, it's showing here, but in America, it's
They've pushed their release, and then like Haunted Mansion. There's a couple of other movies coming out.
Dracula on a boat. I don't know what the actual name of it's called.
Voyage. Yeah, was that the black and white?
Voyage of the Demeter or something?
That one.
Oh, it's such a weird.
Is that what it's called? I just call it Dracula on a boat.
Dracula on a boat.
Yeah.
It's essentially that. It's just so weird. Why would they? Yeah, I don't know.
But all of those have been,
they're all swallowed. Pushed. Yeah. There is Blue Beetle that's still expected to come out later this month.
Which is probably going to tank. I don't think anyone's going to. I think projection-wise, it's even bad.
Yeah. And it doesn't help that it's following from The Flash, which was not.
We're going to talk about these two movies compared to Flash. My new rating system is. Is it better or worse than The Flash?
Is that a new rating score?
It's just my rating system.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, so it's definitely a big box office success, these two movies. We can jump into Oppenheimer first, and there's actually a lot of parallels between
Oppenheimer and Barbie.
There is, just from a studio perspective, because Christopher Nolan was always a Warner Brothers director.
Yeah.
During the pandemic, they decided to release a lot of their movies direct to their streaming service, HBO Max.
Right.
And that resulted in Christopher Nolan exiting from Warner Brothers. And then
that why he left?
Yeah, and then joining Universal. This movie is actually the first Christopher Nolan movie that's not a Warner Bros. Movie. It's a Universal Studios movie. But Barbie is a Warner Bros. Movie.
So it's a war of the studios.
Yeah. So that's interesting. So, I mean, box office-wise, we'll get into it when we talk about Barbie.
But winning.
Yeah,
Warner Bros. I also thought that, like, I think part of the reason, just coming back to the whole phenomena of Barbenheimer, one of the most important reasons, I think the reason why it's so popular is that these two movies could not be more different.
Yeah.
Right? Like one of them is a thought-provoking kind of treatise on like world-ending ideologies and how
it can be used.
And the other one's Oppenheimer.
You got there. Yeah.
I was going there. Yeah. But it's like, you know, you see one with your mates and you see one, like the girls go see one with the girls. So it's like, almost as if we were trying to pull people across from the other aisle to see the movie with us. Like Barbie kind of is like, oh, yeah, bring your boyfriends and, you know, watch it because it was kind of marketed that way, Barbie. Oppenheimer was obviously marketed towards the hardcore Nolan fans.
Yeah.
But everyone's kind of pulling each other to see the others. And the only reason why I feel like we went to see it was to see, A, what the hype was about and, B, to be part of this weird phenomenon, which was like...
That's right.
You know, like get a taste for both of it. And I don't think in both cases, I wasn't... it was something that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
It was very, very
That's kind right. Of, yeah. And they're both, I mean, Christopher Nolan's movies are always quite deep. So that was expected. But Barbie was unexpectedly had a bit of depth as well. The point is if Christopher Nolan hadn't exited Warner Brothers, they wouldn't have released at the same time. That wouldn't have happened because Warner Brothers wouldn't have released two of their movies on the same day.
Yeah.
So
they almost did it. I think they did it purposefully to try and eat the other out. But one thing we didn't expect is that all of the production crew, the actors and people kind of actually bound together and said, let's make this viral. Like you saw like Cillian Murphy and Emily Blunt, and I'm like saying, we're going to watch Barbie. And then you're like, Margot Robbie going, like, we're all going to watch Oppenheimer.
So and Tom Cruise saying he'd watch both.
Yeah, but unfortunately, they didn't reciprocate that. Like,
yeah. He was like, he was trying to third wheel the whole movement, but no one paid attention to him.
Three movies is a bit too much. Three in one weekend's too much, yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know why. Yeah.
Poor Tom Cruise.
I'm going to go watch Mission Impossible. I feel bad now. I'm just like, I need to go watch
it. It's pretty good.
He made it for me. Yeah. Like, he made it like the, pretty, yeah, people like us. Yeah. So I'm just like, oh.
Tom Cruise loves cinema, so he probably still like, he's still probably kicking about. He probably still loves, he's watched them both or whatever.
He was one of the first to watch Tenet as well when during the pandemic, he went and watched
He was one of the first to watch The Flash.
Yes.
And apparently he loved it.
Well, okay, Oppenheimer. Let's talk about that first because that's the movie we watched first.
Yeah, man.
Bit of background. Obviously, Christopher Nolan was the director, but he also wrote the screenplay. Usually, a lot of his previous movies, it was his brother that writes the screenplay, Jonathan Nolan, but this one was written by him. It's got a cast that's probably too big to sort of go through, but obviously, Cillian Murphy is the lead role. I think he'll definitely be... in contention for best actor based off this performance.
Amazing.
And I think Christopher Nolan will, he hasn't been awarded an Academy Award, but he's definitely been nominated for his previous movies. But I think this is probably his best shot out of all of his movies to actually win an Academy Award. Robert Downey Jr., after a long time, returns to the screen. Mm. I think this is his first movie since Endgame.
His first major.
No, there's an excellent movie in between. It's called Doolittle. Very, very good performance.
Was that after Endgame?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, no.
Excellent
way.
Performance.
I keep
excellent.
Forgetting that. Yeah.
He should win an Oscar for that, but he's going to have to win it for this instead.
Yeah.
Both performances are on par, but yeah.
Yes. Yeah. So I think he's definitely in contention for a best supporting role. You forget that he's actually
an actor.
An actor, yeah, because he's always become Tony Stark. Like, he's been Tony Stark for the last 15 years and he's done like other movies like Sherlock Holmes and stuff. But you forget that he is actually quite a good actor.
I had
he's
to
already
watch,
won an Oscar, though.
I think he's actually an incredible artistic actor. Like, in the artsy films, he's great. I had to watch Tropic Thunder again, just to get my like Tony Stark thing out of my mind before I watched Oppenheimer, so I can bring him back to the base of like, all right, he did a really cool role. Now he's go back to doing something like ridiculous, and then my expectations are set. So it's like, he's an actor for me now.
Yes, yeah. And it'll be interesting to see what he does going forward because he can pretty much.
He doesn't need to do it.
He doesn't need to really act, but obviously he did this out of the passion, and he wanted to work with Christopher Nolan as well. Coming to that, I think there's a lot of big name actors, Academy Award winning actors in this movie that are essentially in cameos as well. So
many.
We can get into that maybe in spoilers, but yeah, there's a very big cast. Everyone does a really good job as they always do in Nolan movies. And music. So music is by Ludwig Göransson, who has been featuring in Christopher Nolan movies since Tenet, so since his last one. So his collaboration with Hans Zimmer seems to have ended for now.
I think it's because Hans Zimmer's doing June.
Yes, he's been busy with June.
Part two.
Yeah, well, for Tenet, he was busy with June one, and then, with this, he was busy with part two.
But it's almost as if, like, coming out of the theaters, it's almost as if Hans Zimmer was like, you got this? And Ludwig responded by saying, yeah, I've got this.
Yeah.
Because the result is otherworldly. It's I've never seen something that is like, I was expecting Hans Zimmer, and what I got was something potentially better, which doesn't happen. Because, you know, Ludwig Göransson's soundtrack for, like, in Mandalorian or Tenet, you kind of expect a certain level of, like, oh, that's really electronic.
It's not as much. Nothing more to mention. Cinematography, I'll mention that because that was also quite spectacular. Hoyte van Hoytema, who's been collaborating with Nolan since Interstellar.
Wow.
So Interstellar, since then, he's been the cinematographer for all of his movies. Box office, so let's get to that. So currently it sits at $585 million worldwide.
Nice.
Which is definitely for this kind of movie, if you take the Nolan aspect out of this. So if Christopher Nolan wasn't the director, there's definitely Nolan elements to this story, but I think it's also the most non-Nolan movie. It's much more of a drama. There's no scope for action. It's not that kind of movie.
Yeah.
So it's more of a drama. It's definitely centered around the main character. It's almost from like a – I was thinking about this because all the scenes either have Oppenheimer in them or are about Oppenheimer.
Yep.
So someone else talking about him. The whole movie revolves around him. So there's no scenes where there's no mention of him or he's not in the scene itself.
In other words, this magnificently fails the Bechdel test.
Yes.
Because everyone's always talking about Oppenheimer in some scene. The film is about him. It's based off of a book, a biography. So this film is a biopic.
Yes.
In its nature, like you said, it did feel very un-Nolan-esque.
Yeah.
But in the same way, that's what fascinated me about this movie. It's like Nolan's doing a movie about a historical figure that is really interesting. Like you can't really pull in too many fiction lines from that. You have to draw from facts and history. And this was a really like tumultuous chapter of history that he chose to take like one slice of essentially humanity defining moment.
Yeah.
So that's, I think, what drew people in. Like, oh, he's doing that. It's like George Lucas suddenly deciding to do like, I don't know, Mandela or something, you know, like crazy. It would have been like, wow, what's this going to turn out like? So
Well, I think the parallel is probably something like Steven Spielberg going from Jurassic Park to Schindler's List, something like that, which was in the same year.
Yeah.
Surprisingly, like that would never happen now. But I guess Nolan has done sort of big blockbuster movies and then he's gone and done this movie, which is much more – it's still released in blockbuster season, but it's
more
not
artistic, I would say. It's more what you would expect to come out in November.
Yeah, or like Oscar December. Season. In that Oscar type season.
Yeah.
But yeah, he always interestingly, he always releases his movies on essentially the same date. It's his late July release.
Right.
It might be a problem for when the Oscars come around because people might forget about it. Yeah.
Which used to be the case, but Everything Everywhere All at Once kind of proved that wrong because that released like way before the Oscars.
Oh, yeah, still, you're right. Almost at the beginning of the year, of the cycle. Yeah.
So I think people will still definitely remember this when Oscar time comes around. But the point I was making about the box office was this is quite a large amount of money for the kind of movie it is. Usually this kind of drama Oscar-type movies don't make this much money. So
Yeah. Or don't cost much to make.
That's right. Yeah.
I mean, it also costs a lot.
It's a $100 million budget, which is for the kind of movie it is. It is a big budget.
Yep.
I think a lot of it's for cast itself, probably. That's right. Yeah, probably
cast. I don't think they spent that much for all this film is not a CG reliant film, and I think
also there is no CG shots in the whole film.
Oh, so people say that there isn't any CG shots, but there is visual effects.
Yeah.
So there's everything's real, but it's topped off with visual effects.
Yeah.
Which is very interesting because there were some shots that I thought.
Because some people, when you say there's no CG, it's like, oh, so all of that actually happened. It's like, no.
Oh, yeah.
Like, so it's visual effects.
Visual effects is not necessarily computer generated imagery. You can have some things that embellish real life.
So there wouldn't be any shots where there's humans and
a completely computer generated. Object.
Yeah.
I think the best example that I was shown was like, well, in Lord of the Rings, Gollum is technically a computer generated image.
Yes.
Whereas when they shot images like of actual architecture, like the castle, like Minas Tirith, they used a miniature and a physical object, but they added like the clouds, light rays, which is.
Or they would like add like stuff at the back and make it bigger.
But
when they have the army and then they just add more army at the back, like they
So it's actually based off of something real, but they've multiplied it or something. Yeah. Which is, I think that was a good decision because this isn't a film that they waited to make because the technology hadn't appeared.
Yeah.
It's more so that they waited to make because they wanted to make it as authentic as possible and no one could detonate a bomb in real life up until now, which is like what they wanted to do to recreate that explosion in real life.
And in terms of technology, this was all shot in IMAX, on IMAX film. But apparently they did have to invent black film, black IMAX film for this movie.
Right.
Because there are some shots where it was on black film.
It was on black film.
Okay. I wonder if that's ever going to be used again.
Probably not. I think it's a Nolan special. It's a
one-off thing. Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like it was done just for that one shot.
Yeah.
To get the absolute darkest contrast next to what was the image of the actual money shot of the film. Because if you did it with regular film, what happens is you have the ambient light of the projector is your black. Whereas you use black film, you actually darken that. It's like taking your gamma value and like changing on your TV. You make it darker. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're basically talking about our thoughts on it. I guess we can jump into positives. We've kind of been expressing it already, but we'll start with Bhaskar. What's your biggest positive in this movie? Like if you were telling someone to watch it, what would be sort of the buying factor?
If at any stage in your life you studied physics,
yeah,
or quantum mechanics, or if you're a student or you're fascinated by it, this is a movie that you have to watch because the physics part of it, they don't actually delve into too much physics. It's just mentioned here or there, little morsels are dropped, but like the history of it is.
Yeah, I mean, considering Nolan's Tenet and his other movies, I thought he would go more technical, like actually go into the science a bit more.
Yeah.
But he did, it goes into it, but not as much. It's definitely much more around the character of Oppenheimer rather than the science.
Like they established that he had a brilliant mind, right? And then he used that to take an idea and get a team together and all that. But part of that whole conversation about the visual effects not being too computer reliant, a lot of the effects were analog. They had like a studio that developed all these analog effects of how do you visualize particles? How do you visualize the quantum world? Like electron eigenstates and like, you know, the wave boundaries of between particles and light. They showed that really well in some of the sequences in the film and like the implosion stuff. And I just felt like in the mind, how do you get into the mind of someone who is that brilliant? This was a really good film at trying to show what was going on in someone's mind.
Mm.
And outside of that, the whole film as a complete beginning to end experience, if you expected a film to aggrandize the development of nuclear warheads, it'll surprise you because that's actually, it's very self-aware, this film. It knows what the audience thinks it's about, but it kind of pulls back on that glorifying this action too much because we all know what happens as a result of the history of this event.
Mm.
And what happened in Japan and what happened afterwards and with the whole nuclear arms race thereafter. So it's very self-aware. It's a film that kind of really is thought-provoking because at many times it kind of it tempts you to celebrate an achievement of the team. And at the same time, it kind of asks you to think, well, what's the consequence of this? Which culminates to the very end scene, which is like a masterful writing concept that leaves the audience in a state of dread, which a film should never do because you should be... What's the general rule of filmmaking? You leave the audience with a sense of enlightenment or, you know, closure or, you know, nice, happily ever after feeling. You don't get that with this.
Mm.
Even though you get some moments of like vindication, some moments of like, all right, that worked, that balanced out, it leaves you with a sense of dread and that was done purposefully from the film to the soundtrack to the concepts from the very beginning. And watching it second time through is actually much more enjoyable now that you know what to expect. If you go watch it again now, you'll actually pick up on a lot of the different details of the story. And you're speaking about the science part of it. I actually made a little bingo of like spot the physicist, because you actually do see a lot of physicists in the film, like historical physicists. So like Niels Bohr, Werner Heisenberg, Enrico Fermi, Richard Feynman, one of my like all-time favorite orators.
Avengers of physicists.
is the Avengers of physicists. Yeah. Like Albert Einstein got a cheer in some theaters. And like, so it's really cool seeing all these different like people that you may have heard about.
Heisenberg.
Yeah. And then, that was cool. Just seeing how they were represented. And I don't know, do you guys remember in The Prestige when...
David Bowie's character.
David Bowie did Nikola Tesla. And it was this kind of mythically magic moment when...
That's a bit more fantastical than this.
It was much more fantastical, but they had this kind of mythical moment where he was in front of Tesla. Tesla had this like weird knowledge that just tapped into nature somehow. And he kind of was like telling, walk away, don't do this. Just take your money and go somewhere else because you haven't considered the cost. I felt like this was the analog moment for like Oppenheimer and Einstein. Einstein's telling him like, you know, I know what you want to do. And if you're going to keep doing this, just be careful because you're going to be persecuted. Like essentially that's the message that came across. And only Einstein understood at the very end, like, what the ramifications of this technology was, even though he was the one who wrote the letter to the president saying, Germans are going to make a bomb, we should do it first. That was actually Einstein.
Yeah.
And another scientist who actually warned the president. So, yeah, historically, there's hours and hours of material you could actually talk about in terms of the history and how accurately it's followed. There's a lot of stuff that I wasn't aware about, actually, the whole trial that happened afterwards.
Yes, yeah. And it does center around, well, the whole story centers around that trial. And as most Christopher Nolan movies are, that it is a non-linear story in terms of it goes back and forth between separate timelines.
Yeah. It's very dialogue heavy, which was one thing I wasn't expecting. And I think that was the shock everyone kind of felt. You have to pay attention. There's a lot of dialogue. There's a lot of prose. There's a lot of exchange back and forth. There's a lot of like controversially saucy moments that I wasn't expecting, like for a biopic. And I think I was...
And for a Nolan movie.
I think it was the first time for a Nolan movie. There's nudity and a sex scene in a Nolan movie. So it's like, all right, well, here this is why it's R, you know? It wasn't R. I thought it was going to be R for like... It's going to show the horrific effects of nuclear warheads. And I was like, they did show that, but that's not why it's R. So, that's probably my positives.
Maybe you can go with your positives.
I don't know. Basker's pretty much covered a lot of them there.
Yeah.
I think the main thing is the performances, really. That's probably what you come out of this mostly.
Remembering.
I'm not a huge fan of, like, war movies in general. Like, I don't like most of them. Well, most of them are done quite well, but I don't really go back to watch them or anything like that, like Schindler's List or like 1917 or something like that.
It's a hard film to watch.
Yeah. They're all quite good, but difficult to watch. I would put this movie in that kind of category in terms of what it is. Yeah.
I mean, it's not a war, as in there's no war sequences, but it's talking about the war.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's set during, before the time of war and then
after.
Just at the end of it, essentially. But overall, what you come out of it is the performances.
Yeah.
Cillian Murphy, Emily Blunt, Robert Downey Jr. They're probably the standouts for me.
Yeah. Matt Damon was pretty good as well.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. I think Matt Damon was. I don't think anyone's bad in this movie, but like everyone is really good. But Cillian Murphy, especially, is like amazing. But yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Definitely Oscar worthy.
And you talked about the music. The music's good. Cinematography is all great. There's not much to dislike about it. Like, even a person that doesn't like war movies will come out of it saying they think it's pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I agree with all the positives. I can talk about one of the sort of negatives, and it's a negative that has come up with a lot of Christopher Nolan movies, and that's just the sound mixing. It's not as bad.
No, it's better than this. It's not as bad. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's definitely not as bad as Tenet, but definitely like towards the start of the movie, I was like, oh no, here we go again, because I couldn't hear some of the stuff they were saying, and obviously there's a lot of scientific terms that are thrown around, and you really need to like concentrate to go with, you know, understand what's going on, because it is a dialogue-heavy movie.
I would say it's like at least 50% better than Tenet, though. Like
the sound mixing?
Yeah, it's definitely much better in terms of – because Tenet was nearly inaudible, I reckon. It was like –
in some
– yeah.
It was almost intentionally done, because Christopher Nolan was like, you're not meant to understand the film, you're meant to feel it. And it's like, I get what he's trying to go for, but in order to feel it, we need to first understand it.
Yeah.
So it's like Oppenheimer's line in his movie. It's like they won't understand it unless they've used it. In this one, you have to hear that.
Like a problem for Nolan since Interstellar. That's just like wrapped
progressively
up.
Progressively got
worse, and then Tenet was like the peak, and now it's coming back down.
So that's probably the only major sort of thing that I had. I think it is like, it's not for everyone. I think it is a long movie. It's 3 hours long. And you have to go in with certain expectations. So don't go in expecting like a Prestige or an Inception or any of those movies.
But I'm surprised that a lot of people that I probably wouldn't expect to have liked this did like it.
Yeah.
Thought it was good. Mm.
So I think a lot of people who didn't like Inception seemed to like this because they found that it was more grounded.
Yeah.
It was more obviously based on real like life events. So it's less fantastical.
I think it's really like a dad movie, but like a white dad movie, not to be racist.
Oh, yeah. But yeah. No. I see what you mean. It's based in the good old 40s where, you know, men were men and women were women. So it's like the established roles. Everyone knew what they were doing, military function, Manhattan Project. It's like the most like dude kind of film there is. However, there is an also a kind of nuance and element where it's like I think the danger and the horrors of science and the progression of weaponry and how it can get to a point where you're like, once you start to tinker with these magical forces of nature, you get to a point where it becomes almost world ending. And that's the danger which they were treading. And that kind of brought everyone back to feel like, well, this is like an existential film almost, to the point where, we know where it's set, but the dangers of what they were trying to do is kind of revealed in this film. And look, to be honest, they made it feel authentic. I think they actually built that whole Los Alamos place. They built it for the production of the film. They recreated the explosion, which is, I don't know how they did it. Obviously, they didn't use nuclear grade materials, but they recreated the explosion somehow. And all the scenes that were shot in the beginning of the film, by the way, in Europe, were actually done in like Cambridge, Oxford, like the Dutch universities. So that's really
the actual location.
It's pretty cool that they use the actual locations.
Yeah,
they use Robert Oppenheimer's actual home in one of the scenes.
Oh, okay.
Nolan's good at making things look real. Nothing looks like it's shot in a cupboard.
Yeah, and that's why his movies tend to age pretty well, because they use mostly practical effects. So even like Batman Begins, which came out in 2005, still looks better than a lot of the superhero movies that are
coming out
this year.
Lots of movies have just over-reliant on CG at this point, where they use it not to embellish but to just create everything.
They're trying to recreate the comic book panel in film, which is maybe not what Nolan was going for. He was trying to create the original story that inspired the comic book afterwards, like as if this was some sort of real event that happened, which, we need to bring back, I think.
So I don't think there's too many spoilers as such.
If you're born after 1945, you probably know the spoiler.
Spoiler alert. Read your history books.
But in terms of like a cameos, Gary Oldman is a cameo as
Truman. President Truman.
Truman.
He was really good.
These are the Oscar, like the Academy Award winning actors that are doing cameos. So Rami Malek was another very small
role. Up throughout the movie and you're like, is this all they're going to use it for? And then he does like an exposition dump at the end.
David Hill, I think, is the eight Enrico Fermi.
And then Kenneth Branagh is there as
Niels Bohr.
So he seems to be a regular in Nolan movies now, having featured in Tenet as well. One person that wasn't in this movie was Michael Caine, unless I missed him, but I don't think he was. Yeah.
No,
it's his first movie he's done movies. First movie in a while that he has.
Yeah. In a while, you're right.
I think he was in every movie since Begins, I'm pretty sure. Every Nolan movie, because he was in Inception, he was in Interstellar, he was in...
he would have been good in this one, actually. Yeah.
Tenet.
Yeah.
Was he in Dunkirk?
Yes, so maybe. Yeah. But possibly not, maybe. Maybe he keeps him out of the war movies.
I don't remember him in Dunkirk.
Was Michael Caine alive during the war? He possibly would have been.
I reckon so. He would have been.
He's in his 80s, right?
Yeah. Maybe it's too close.
He would have been really young.
It's too close to home, so he just keeps him out of it.
Potentially.
Yeah.
But Cillian Murphy, so he's featured in a lot of Nolan movies in the past.
Oh, yeah.
But never as a lead actor.
I think it's his sixth.
He was in Begins. He was in The Dark Knight.
He was in Inception.
He was in Inception.
He was in Rises as well.
Was he in Rises?
Yeah, he's the judge.
Oh, yeah, he was. Yeah, he was in Rises. Yep.
Yeah.
He was Inception in Dunkirk.
So
he's in Tenet? I don't think he was in Tenet.
Tenet. Yeah. But he's in most of his movies.
Yeah.
He finally got the opportunity to be a lead in his movies.
And he's done well. He's killed it.
Absolutely amazing.
Yeah.
That's a main takeaway. Go watch it for Cillian Murphy, I think.
I think so.
Yeah. Like there's one, like, we're still spoiler free.
No, we can jump in spoilers.
Yeah. But there's that one scene where he, like, after the bombs have been dropped and he's addressing Los Angeles, like very all the young people. Scene. There's like an anxiety inducing scene where he's trying to celebrate, but he knows what just happened. And that scene is like,
it's like the most horror kind of,
it's so unsettling. It's the most accurate depiction of like an anxiety attack that I've seen in film, which is so.
And then there's the imagery of, you know, what the bomb would have done to the, to one lady.
Right.
And
like,
yeah.
And then it's got like a charred body on the ground as well.
Yeah.
It's like the closest. I would be intrigued to see Nolan do a horror movie and see how that looks like.
That would be interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'd like to see him explore other genres.
He is very sci-fi heavy. This is not that sci-fi heavy, but he is, he should try other stuff. They're talking about James Bond for him, which I think would be great. But I think Tenet was kind of his James Bond, which is, I don't like Tenet.
Even his other, like Inception had elements of a Bond as well, like in terms of, you know, the heist and stuff. But I don't know if Bond will, he needs like full creative freedom with anything. Which is
why he did Batman.
Yeah, and I think he had mostly creative freedom with that. Like with Begins, I think they're just like, because Batman and Robin was the previous Batman movie. So it's just like
Bond might be a bit too shallow for him, because in every movie he does, I think the essence of it is that there is something elemental, something like stripping between nature and like the destruction or the destructive power of what's underneath nature in every film, right? So like in Batman, it was this kind of sense of greater than yourself power. In Inception and in Tenet, everything is about like, you know, the inversion or time or entropy inversion. In this, it's about the boundary between the strong force of quantum mechanics. How do you unleash that?
Yeah.
And that wasn't known until that moment in time. So I was like, he's got to find something. I think he needs that crack between everyday stuff and something otherworldly or like ethereal to talk about.
Which and is even why these like movies before Batman. So, Memento is his first theatrical film, and Insomnia. Even those were not straightforward movies.
Yeah,
you could make a non-straightforward Bond movie, though. I don't know if I don't know how tightly they hold on to that that property. And they,
I'm guessing he's not going to get as much freedom with that, unless they just they just let him do it, but. I would actually, like you said, a horror movie, that would be very interesting from Nolan, because there'd definitely be like a...
That would be.
You can combine sci-fi and horror, so you can definitely do something there.
Yeah.
And
that's like the definition of things that cross over into the otherworldly. You could definitely touch that.
Yeah,
like but it would have to be something that's like maybe even like you'd have to try a thriller first before doing full horror.
Something.
I'd love to see it because I've seen like
just that one scene in this. It seemed like he could do something pretty cool.
Even
with
in Prestige, like when Hugh Grant. What am I thinking of?
Hugh Jackman's
moment where he reveals that he's been killing versions of himself.
And you like, see that. Yeah,
like that was a very horror scene. If you think about it, like the vials of dead Hugh Jackman's like just lining the basement.
And even the scene where his wife that drowns to death during a. That's in Inception.
In
Prestige, where they're doing a trick and then
she's in the thing.
That's he could do it. He could definitely pull it off. But I feel like the direction he hinted at something at the end of Oppenheimer, where like when they name drop JFK.
Oh yeah,
and I had a visceral reaction.
Because in Tenet, they name drop Oppenheimer.
Yeah, because in every film, they kind of slightly hint at stuff. And also, there's a nice reference to black holes in Oppenheimer. It looks back at so Oppenheimer actually did a lot of work developing theory of black holes before he did this stuff.
Yeah,
but I felt it was like a reference to Interstellar because he's like referencing work. But when they name drop JFK, it just felt like that wasn't a subtle name drop. It felt like he's gonna touch on this again sometime in the future.
Yeah.
I feel like I want him to go away from a realistic story.
Yeah.
And do something fantastical again.
Yeah.
Because I did like this movie, but also I want him to see him doing something crazy.
Like a proper Nolan. Yeah. Mind trip. You're right.
So also if you find Nolan movies too hard to understand, this is not one of those ones. It's generally pretty easy to understand.
You can understand it. Yeah. Like there's no like crazy twists or anything. It's just, it is what it is.
Yeah. Maybe don't bring your parents, for the first watching.
Well, I think parents just watch it separately. I think the parents watch it separately and the kids watch it separately.
if you happen to be in India, you can go watch it with your siblings because they've cut out a lot of stuff and it's actually PG there. So it's like they've edited it to the point where they're there. So
it does have CG shots in India.
CG shots. They use
some CG.
CG to cover up. Yeah.
Fair enough.
Oh, yeah, that's going to pop. Yeah, that was interesting.
So I thought we'd quickly rank our top three Nolan movies. I've thought about it, so I can go first.
Ooh, good work.
So third for me is Batman Begins. I know a lot of people don't put this in their top five even, but I think this is just the definitive superhero origin movie. Since then, like...
What about The Flash?
Close second. Close
yeah, okay,
second.
Yeah.
Was that
yeah.
directed by Nolan?
Close second. But yeah, I think it's still probably the best superhero origin movie. Everyone's trying to sort of replicate its success since then. So that's my third. Second is Inception. So Inception, I think that's the quintessential Nolan. When you think of Nolan, it's probably Inception or Interstellar. For me, yeah, Inception was still a great movie. And every time I watch it, I still – there's a lot of depth, like philosophical depth to that movie that I always find some new things about every time I watch it. And number one will still have to be The Dark Knight.
I thought you were going to say Tenet.
No. Nice.
Although I was thinking about it.
I don't hate Tenet as much as everyone thinks I hate Tenet. But I don't like Tenet, but I don't hate it as much.
I was like, would I watch Oppenheimer again or would I watch Tenet again?
I would watch Tenet again because I still don't know if I can understand it. I want to know if I can. Yeah. I probably can't.
I know there was a point where you and Budgie like thought you understood it, and then I came in and go, no, that can't be right because if you invert entropy, that's not right. So they actually made you disunderstand the film after like you thought you understood it. So I was like, you could actually break your understanding with that film. It's crazy.
Well, if you want to get even more confused about Tenet, listen to our review where Kiridi featured. And
Kiridi claims he still understands it.
Basically, Kiridi and Tarun just argued for an hour and a half.
I think I did hear about that. Yeah. And you didn't help me. didn't help my understanding at all.
Yeah.
But I think I would watch Tenet over Oppenheimer. But Oppenheimer is still very good.
I think they both are like, they're tiring movies in the sense you'd really got to concentrate. Most Nolan movies you have to concentrate, but those two I felt like I actually felt physically tired. Even after this one, I was like, I just need to like take a rest. I need to sleep and like just. But yeah, that's my top three. I think Dark Knight is still his best movie for me. I still really enjoyed it. And it's like it's a superhero movie. It is, but it's not really. It explores much.
It's an anti-hero movie for me. Yeah. But it's still I remember we watched it for your birthday. We went to Knox, right? Yeah. That's probably one of my best cinematic experiences that I've been to.
Yeah.
Yeah, just off the top of my head. That was like, wow, I was not expecting that.
Yeah.
Coming out of theaters.
2008, that movie came out. So 2008.
It's crazy, man.
Same year as Iron Man 1.
Yeah.
That's it's also a good movie, but Dark Knight's very,
Theron, about you, top three?
I think Dark Knight is number one. I'm going to go reverse order.
Reverse order.
Yeah. Dark Knight, it's just a good movie. I think over time it's one of those movies that everyone just likes. So when you say it's really good, it just feels very mundane.
It's like, of course it is. Like, but
yeah, it's like it's a very common take, but it's still a very good movie. Yeah.
Yeah.
The thing about The Dark Knight is like a grounded superhero movie, but it is still a superhero movie. It's
still very comic book accurate.
Yeah. But like nowadays when they do like a superhero movie and they're trying to make it grounded, such as The Joker is not a superhero movie. It is just a crazy guy in Gotham. I don't hate The Joker. It's not a bad movie, but it's not a superhero movie.
Yeah. And it's not it's a take on the Joker origin.
Yes. But
it's
not comic book accurate at all. Yeah. From by any standard. But The Dark Knight does a grounded superhero movie whilst keeping the superhero aspects in it.
The best part of The Dark Knight is they never explain where this guy came from, where the Joker, he just appears and he just starts causing chaos.
Which is the right way to do it.
Yeah.
It's weird that people make superhero movies. They used to do this back in the early 2000s as well, make superhero movies for people that don't like superheroes and like, oh, we got to make this appeal to the wider audience so we can't put any superhero elements in it. Then why are you making a superhero movie? But yeah, The Dark Knight does it well with both aspects.
Yeah.
I think Inception's also my second favorite. Very good movie. Inception's close to being my first favorite as well.
Yeah, but same with me. Like taking away the, the Batman movies, Inception is definitely up there.
But I think for three, it's either The Prestige or Interstellar for me.
Fair enough.
But the ending of Interstellar is just a bit weird. So I'll probably go Prestige over that.
Prestige is also very...
The ending of Interstellar just ruins it a little bit. Like, it makes sense according to all the physicists and everyone, but also it's just a little bit too fantastical.
Yeah, it's got that creative element.
Yeah.
That's what... otherwise, Interstellar would be in my top three as well. I think it's just that end. Ever since Interstellar, actually, I've always had something that I wasn't quite comfortable with in all Nolan movies.
Since Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, Dark Knight Rises. Yeah. Although when Dark Knight Rises came out, I really liked that movie, but I can see the flaws.
There is plenty of – Dark Knight Rises has the most plot holes out of any Nolan movie, except maybe Tenet, but I don't understand the plot enough to know what the plot holes are.
Yeah.
But Dark Knight Rises has a lot of plot holes.
And there's talk that he didn't want to do Rises, but they sort of made him do it. Because I think if he had the option, he probably wouldn't have done it. Yeah.
Hmm. I agree. Yeah. In terms of my top three, I'll go with like the reverse up. My third one is definitely, I think Inception is going to be my third. Just purely out of that whole zeitgeist of that film when it came out in 2011 and what it did. It's still to this day the only film where I went to see it by myself with a group of other randoms in the theater, and basically it was half packed. It wasn't that popular back then. And by the time the film finished, literally everyone just started talking to each other.
Yeah.
And I've never seen that in a film ever, right? Random people talking like, what, was he still dreaming? Did you see what happened there? Like, how good was this? Like, that never happens. And I've only seen that happen once, and that was during Interstellar. And like, we watched it, Inception, watched it a couple more times. I really wish they'd do a sequel to it. To Inception, with another character.
Another thing that Nolan doesn't do is sequels.
He doesn't.
Yeah. Other than these Batman movies,
which is a shame because that world that he'd built was so amazing.
Lots of people thought Tenet was going to be set in the Inception universe.
Well, it could be.
It could have actually.
But they've got common actors.
Yeah, but it's like the rules of the universe is just simply they opened up a new rule.
Yeah,
like time inversion. So it's like the fact that he's playing around with this stuff, that was the first really imaginative like world that he built from scratch, and like it did wonders.
Yeah.
So cinematically it was great. Story was amazing.
And the beauty of Interstellar, Interstellar as well, but Inception is it is complex, but you can understand it.
Yeah.
I think that's where Tenet fails, is that it's incredibly difficult to understand Tenet.
I think they get progressively more difficult. Like Inception and then Interstellar is a level above that.
Yep.
Yeah. And then Tenet is a level above that as well.
My second one is Dark Knight, without a doubt. That's like I still remember when we went to see it, that was the age of where superhero films was just coming out, like Iron Man and I think Hulk had come out in 2006. And it was the end of the old school superhero movies and the start of the new Marvel kind of universe. People are really kind of thirsting for these actual mutant level superhero films. And then Dark Knight came out, and I remember going to it, coming out and feeling like, this isn't a superhero film. This is a hero film. This is like a human being with no mutations, no superpowers. He's just doing this out of sheer will. And he's facing some other messed up human being who's doing it out of sheer will. And they've ruined some like lives of many other people. It just felt so devastating. So like awesome to watch. And I felt like this is what like DC films need to be. They need to be dark, they need to be gritty, they need to be real. And we have to stop relying on all of these like, you know, aliens from outer space and mutants and you know, like X-ray vision and that kind of stuff. It's kind of like, I wish that we went back to those principles now, because we really need it now. The state of Marvel and DC as well, it's just like, it's just like super saturated.
Yeah.
Right? We've had enough of that. We going back to that time and era, it's going to be really hard, because that movie is almost, it's near flawless, Dark Knight. The only one that beats it for me, and this is a purely experience level thing, and that I've watched it multiple times, and my number one is Interstellar to this day, just because of my like love for space travel and the general concepts of like, ever since I was in high school, that's what I was pretty much thinking about, like, oh shit, special relativity is a thing. It actually works.
Yeah.
And he went and did a film about it. And me and my mate that we did physics together in high school, we literally have watched it every single time it's rerun in IMAX. We just go back and watch it again. Because it's like the soundtrack, the story elements. we kind of we got the whole thing. Like the ending was just purely imaginative because we don't know what's inside a black hole. But we kind of just accepted the fact that, all right, we don't know. They made some creative element. So it's like, if you accept that, that's fine.
I think the first time you watch it, it's a bit jarring. Yeah. But after you accept that, he's in the bookcase or whatever, it's just like,
he's the bookcase.
Yeah, it's fine.
This is some construct. Yeah. I'm just gonna accept this and follow Christopher Nolan's advice. I'm just gonna feel it.
Yeah.
It's just like it still hits that emotional barrier.
Yeah.
Because they could have easily just killed off, Matthew McConaughey's character, Cooper. They could have killed him off and made it like a symbolic thing through time that, Murph felt his presence. Yeah, it was a very well done movie from beginning to end, and I think it still leaves a lot to think about afterwards. Like, what is after watching that, what is the main message of that movie? Are we going to do anything about it as people, as a cinematic thing? It was the first one to kind of provoke and really kind of ask me the question, like saying, "Well, are we going to continue being the frontier chasing people that we used to always be, or are we going to go back to the sedentary life?" So it was a wonderful commentary at the time when it came out of like, do we just stick our head in the dirt or do we try and, reach for new horizons?
Yeah.
So yeah, it was a really, that was fine. For me, that was number one film.
No, it is a great film. Especially for me, I like the science aspects of it, but I think the underlying story between him and his daughter is really what drives that film.
Yeah.
And I think that's what Nolan does well is the characters. He does have a complex plot around these characters, but the character relations and the way he portrays them, I think that's his real strength, and that's one of the flaws of Tenet, I guess, is what we talked about.
Yeah, the characters don't have names in that movie.
Yeah,
Well, they have names they mentioned like once.
Well, the main character is called the protagonist.
Yeah, but it doesn't have a name. So
I was going to say my favorite part in Interstellar is when they're trying to get back onto the base, and then they're like, "What are you doing to Matthew McConaughey?" He's like, "Ducking."
Ducking, yeah.
That's my favorite part.
That's a great scene. And then the organ stuff playing in the background. Yeah.
Oh, that was Interstellar's one of – he has great soundtracks in all of them, but that's a great
– I think he liked that soundtrack so much that he put it over the dialogue. He's like, "I don't give a shit about the dialogue. Listen to the soundtrack."
That is true. There's just the one element in every single film where – the concept of like romance and love slightly brings down the feeling. Like Interstellar is this really thought-provoking film. In the middle of it, it just starts talking about how love is this mystical force that connects people beyond space and time. I'm like, it's bullshit. Like, why would you put that line in a really scientific film?
What's her name says it, right?
Anne Hathaway says it. And I'm like, you didn't need that. And even in Oppenheimer, I felt like very similar. Like, this is a really technically scientific film. You don't need elements of like romance and love and what will you do if I need you? It's just like, that doesn't belong in a film about this man. They put it in there to show that he made the connection of death with Jean's kind of affection. And when she died, he forever connected that feeling with her. But that's my one kind of downside of all of these films is somehow I don't know why he feels a need to introduce this superfluous element, which doesn't really get touched on any other time. It's just that one moment and that's it.
Yeah.
It's pulled back.
I think in Inception it does work really well with his relationship with his wife.
Yes. Because it's a continuous thread.
Yeah. But I can see it in other movies where it feels a bit forced.
Yeah. In Dark Knight, it was almost like the devastating effect of that. Like,
yeah.
She's saying, I love Harvey Dent. And that truth was never given to Bruce. And that was a much more devastating form of it, but it was done realistically,
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. If you said, I will always love you for who you are, going on, and that he received that would have been corny as hell.
Yeah.
That's what's keeping him going. Like, I'm glad he chose not to do that.
One thing I will say about Oppenheimer, we didn't mention this, but the interrogation scenes, really well done with Jason Clarke, I believe, was the main sort of questioner in those scenes. Australia's Own, yeah. But this scene with him and Emily Blunt was one of the best scenes in the movie. And that's where Emily Blunt really, really shines in this role.
That was really good. Yeah. When you said interrogation scene, I was still in Dark Knight for a second. So I was like, I had to get myself out.
Where is he?
Where is he?
Anything else on Oppenheimer?
It's pretty good. Go watch it.
Yeah, amazing soundtrack. Don't feel the need to go watch the 1570 presentation. The 4K presentation is just as good. And there's plenty of seats available. Yeah.
Yeah, I think you could probably watch. I think IMAX would be really good, but like you don't need to watch this in the film version or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah, I think it'll have as long as it's got good sound. Yeah. It's fine.
Actually, the sound is more important in this film than the visuals, to be honest. Mm. I thought it was the visuals, it's the sound. So if you can watch it in an IMAX, go watch it for the sound. Don't worry about the visuals too much. But yeah, that's a definite recommendation for us to go watch it.
It's a cognitive recalibration from
me. It's better than The Flash.
All right.
Yeah. It's a neutron chain reaction from us.
Cool. Okay. We'll jump into Barbie in a second.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Yep. All right, Barbie.
Barbie. Here we go.
Our guest has been very committed to the cause, so he's come dressed.
I didn't bring this to the screening, but I thought I'd bring it to the podcast.
Yes,
We can show the full colors off.
Yeah. I was planning to wear pink as well, but I forgot. I mean, I could go and change, but
it's too late for that now.
Too late.
We're truly started.
We'll do it live. We'll do it live.
Let's CGI it in later.
Yes. I'll do it in post.
Do it in post, yeah.
So we watched Barbie second in the Barbenheimer weekend. This movie is directed by Greta Gerwig, of Lady Bird and Little Women fame. Well, those are previous big movies. So this is, let's talk about the box office before we get into the actual thoughts on the movie. So it's just done over $1 billion worldwide, just ticked over that last weekend, actually.
Crazy.
So we're recording this about 3 weeks after release. It's already hit the $1 billion. It's likely to cross the current highest grossing movie of the year, which is Super Mario Brothers. At $1.3 billion. Wow. They're projecting it to get to about $1.5. And if it does get to $1.5, that will make it the highest grossing movie directed by a female. It's already the highest grossing movie solely directed by a female. The highest grossing movie that was co-directed by a female is Frozen 2. So that's
Frozen 2, nice.
Yeah, $1.4 billion. But this is already a solo female director. This is the highest grossing movie. So it's already beating some records in that respect. As you would probably already know, Margot Robbie is the female lead, is Barbie.
She's a producer, right?
She's also a producer. Her and her husband are also producers. She plays stereotypical Barbie. So there's a lot of Barbies in this movie.
Yeah. A lot of Barbies, a lot of Kens.
It's like a multiverse.
One Alan.
Yeah.
Yes.
One Alan.
Is that just a character that they made up?
No, he's a real thing.
It was an actual doll.
He's an actual doll.
It was called Alan, and he's Ken's best friend.
Ken's best friend. Something like that.
Yeah.
So Ryan Gosling is one of the Kens. and there's a pretty big cast. So we were talking about cameos in Oppenheimer. This also has a lot of cameos. Cameos of a different level of prestige, but cameos nonetheless. So we can talk about that once we get into spoilers. How did we want to talk about it? We can jump into positives and negatives about this movie.
Initial impressions
first. Yeah, and if you were trying to sell this to someone who hadn't watched it,
I'll be honest, I wasn't expecting much. I just saw the trailer. It's like, if you love Barbie, this is the film for you. If you hate Barbie, this is the film for you. And I'm like, all right, they're self-aware, that's great. So I didn't expect much from this film, to be honest. I was just like, all right, we'll just go watch it and have a good time and see what it's about. But I was quite surprised. it was definitely a deeper film than it seems to be on the surface.
On the surface, yeah, definitely.
But I'll be honest, like the team behind it, it's got a very intelligent team behind it, because the idea is they've made a really kind of provoking, thought-provoking film, and they've packaged it as a Barbie film. So if it ever receives criticism,
it's just Barbie.
It's almost like it's ridiculous. Like, you're
it's grown, just Barbie.
It's just Barbie. There are grown men out there who are like criticizing Barbie because of this, and I'm just laughing. I'm going, checkmate. You've been checkmated. This is like the best way to deliver.
Do you know Ben Shapiro? Yeah. Do you know who that guy is? Yeah. He made a 44-minute
dissertation,
review, I guess,
rant
about this movie. Yeah. About why it's not good. The movie goes for 2 hours, doesn't it?
Yeah.
He did 1/3 size of the movie. He went through a rant about not liking it.
It's ridiculous. Yeah. I enjoyed the movie. I actually went into it and I found it enjoyable. If you can find this movie, if you can laugh at yourself and be like, if you're a guy and you can laugh at yourself watching this movie, and just know that you're watching a movie that's called Barbie and it's about Barbie. That's the point of the film. It's not called G.I. Joe. It's not called Power Rangers, you know. It's fine, you know. It's great. Go watch it. Don't take it too seriously. It's just like, it's not a Nolan movie. It's not a commentary on the human condition. Right. But it is a commentary on, it is definitely a movie about, you know, feminism in a way. Greta Gerwig is an open feminist. But yeah, look, it's just go watch the film. Then think of what you feel like, and if you feel like smashing something, something's wrong with you.
Yeah, maybe just look internally a little bit if you think that way.
Internally, lay off YouTube for a bit and just take a chill.
It is very self-aware, which I think plays to its advantage, and it's actually very funny. It was probably the funniest movie I've seen this year.
It's one of the funniest movies I've seen in a while.
It's good.
Yeah.
The humor is just like, it's relevant. It's spot on.
Yeah.
Even they poke fun at themselves. They poke fun at Barbie.
They poke fun at everything. Like, nothing's off limits. Yeah.
Well, I mean, like, within the sense of like, they're self-deprecating, but at the same time, it's like being self-aware, that's important. Because if you're not self-aware, the audience is going to be like 10 miles ahead of you. And you're just going to keep thinking like, oh, you know, we're in a moral position of superiority. No, they actually take it all out. They make fun of their own company. Like, they actually take the piss out of Mattel.
Yeah.
Which is hilarious. Like Colin Farrell.
Yeah.
Will Farrell. He's actually really good in the role as the CEO of Mattel.
He's hilarious. He's
basically just playing himself. I think he's just... Yeah. They just got Will Ferrell on set and just said, do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Any other positives?
I think it's just really funny. I think it's just a funny movie. Yeah.
Yeah, look, it's good. You could definitely talk about this. I know Carvey was there when we talked about it, and it was like she had certain thoughts and kind of things to talk about in deep kind of fashion. Again, it's like we're three guys talking about a movie that was made for girls.
Yeah.
So we do have to.
I think you'd relate to it more as a female. I think from all the girls I've talked to that have watched it, they said that like lots of stuff in this movie they do relate to strongly.
Especially if you grew up playing
that does resonate.
But I do hear from a lot of them that they wish they went a bit further with some of it. But I didn't particularly feel that way, but like
interesting. Well, there's one particular. This is maybe one. This is the only negative from me. Mm. There was one scene where I thought it was a bit too heavy-handed. I don't know if it's not just me. A lot of people have expressed this, but I felt it was talking a bit too directly about these. And I know, like, a lot of women love that scene.
I know what you're talking about.
Yeah. I know the one.
Yeah.
I think. it's not relatable to us.
Maybe.
Which is the difficult part. But I also thought it was
maybe they could have done it a bit more elegantly. I thought it was a little bit too forceful in the way it was represented. But still,
I think everyone, I think that scene had to be in there. I think all the people I've talked to that have seen that scene say it had to be in there.
It kind of felt like the movie was almost building up to that scene, but they couldn't just show that scene.
Yeah.
That's what I got from different people. But I know exactly what you're talking about. And look, to be honest, again, it comes back to that thing of saying, well, if they chose this as a delivery method to express all of these different kind of ideas and different concepts that maybe are not usually expressed in film, because I'll be honest, like the history of filmmaking is a generally male-dominated kind of exercise where we talk about historical figures or heroes or something. So I think the reason why this is doing so well is it's pulling in a crowd of people who generally aren't avid film goers, or maybe are just casuals, or maybe just, you know, mums or people who don't really get out there, or girls who don't find most movies nowadays appealing. They're really going out to see this film. It's pulling huge numbers.
Mm.
And I think the reason why is because it's got a message that resonates with 50% of the population, which is huge.
Yeah.
If you could do that.
They actually did a demographic study on the opening weekend of Barbenheimer. I think the audience for Oppenheimer was, I'm going to say 65% male, something around that. Are they 65 or 70% male? Okay. And they're basically reverse for Barbie.
Right.
Yeah. So it's obviously skewed to certain.
Skewed. That's interesting. I would have thought the differences would be much higher, but that's interesting.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Like it's not a film that portrays guys in any competent light. That's one negative I had.
Yeah.
In that, it just shows guys as being either default or pretty much useless.
Yeah.
Like even the guys in the real world where, you know, the main protagonist's husband and the girl's father.
Yeah.
It's just this random dude who's...
And there is commentary about they go into the real world, obviously, and there's commentary about how things are structured in the real world.
Yeah. Almost to a hyperbolic level.
Yeah,
it's a hyperbole level. Yeah. But I think...
It's really interesting to see how some people took that literally, like saying, oh, you know, it's not like not attack. All yeah. construction work builders are, you know, misogynist people. And it's just like, I get it. This film is a fantastical film. Everyone's wearing hot pink.
Yeah.
And even when they go to the real world, everyone's like super abusive to them, like in Miami. Like, I haven't been to Miami.
Yeah.
Was it Miami
LA?
Or was it
LA?
It was LA. Yeah. Like, I'm I don't know. I don't know if the streets of LA are that brutal, but it's like, look, there are certain things that they have to bring into the real world, and you can't get that when you're watching it from a film about a toy.
Yeah.
I don't think it's meant to be realistic at all. Like, it's a hyperbole of both situations are a hyperbole, and I think everyone in this movie is stupid as well. Like, on purpose, everyone in this movie is stupid.
Yeah. The only other negative I'd say is I think that there is a message in this movie, but and we can talk about it more in spoilers and explain what I mean. But they kind of at the end of it, it kind of goes back to the status quo. And I think they were trying to make a point.
I think that is part of the message though.
Yeah, I don't know if I don't know if that was the point. I think they were trying to say that it should be a different way. And maybe the Barbie world could have reflected that, but at the end of the movie it's back to like what it was before. So I was like, well, interesting way to end the movie where you were trying to push a sort of message,
which
and then
I have something to say about
is that, trying to highlight the real world though, like people want change and then essentially they get to a certain point and they're like, oh, we've done enough, like this is enough change.
In that sense, even though they're trying to poke fun at the absurdity of the inequality of real life by doing a reverse in a potentially hypothetical world, but they missed a lot of things in between. Like in making that point of satire, they're actually missing a lot of stuff, which is worrying, because when you make a joke, you have to be aware of, okay, you're making fun of the inequality of the real life situation. So you make a joke, but when you portray like the group that you're trying to make fun of and you portray them as like incompetent, that's not how it is in the real world. We don't look at the other group and think they're incompetent. That's not what's happening. So if that's their view of why it's happening, it's a very immature view of the real world, which is kind of what the status quo image, they're trying to portray something. It's worrying. It's like, is this what you really think of the real world? Because that's worrying if it is.
Yeah. I guess we can get more into that in
None of this is going to make sense if you haven't seen the movie.
Yeah, exactly.
You're going to think, like, where did the dolls come in? Are you talking about hats? Like,
and that's another thing. This is not made for girls that play with Barbies currently.
Oh, it could be. Like, it could be a first introduction to it, but it's a lot of the shit's going to fly.
Yeah, exactly. I don't think they'll enjoy it the way that you'd expect them to.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's
maybe the first half.
I think maybe the elements of the Barbie. And this is also a musical.
Yes.
By the way, so that there are songs in it.
It's got, like, good music.
Yeah.
It's mostly Dua Lipa, but it's good.
Yeah.
It had some numbers like La La Land, like they'll just break out into, like,
oh, and yeah, song, Ryan Gosling, like Ryan does Gosling. An amazing song in this. Yeah.
I thought the performances were good as well. So Margot Robbie's obviously a very good actress, and she's
probably, like, the most serious role in this, and she pulls it off.
Yeah,
yeah.
Everyone else is kind of stupid and quirky. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ryan Gosling is hilarious.
Yes.
Yeah.
He's obviously the complimentary. He's not got his own limelight in this. He's just complimenting the performance from Margot Robbie.
Yes.
So yeah.
Margot Robbie did very well to, like, she carries the movie, essentially. Yeah.
Yes. Like, there are moments where it's, like, lighthearted. There are moments where she's not being 100% serious. And there's moments where it's deathly serious.
Yeah.
Not deathly, but, like, to her existence. And she pulls off that really well.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's hard.
Another thing I thought they were going to explore, but they kind of got, you know, sidelined it for the patriarchy stuff. But they did talk about the sort of the element of capitalism associated with Barbie.
Right.
The fact that they mention it in, like, one scene in particular, where I thought they were going to explore that a bit more and talk about, like, how Barbie is kind of trying to promote feminism, but at the same time it's, like, this very
consumerist
property.
Yep.
I thought they were going to follow that a little bit, but they kind of sidelined that.
They didn't. They're self-aware, but not to a point of criticality.
Yeah.
Which is which is, I think, I'm Oppenheimer now. that's interesting. That's a really interesting point. Yeah.
Yeah. But I really enjoyed the movie. So I had a lot of fun with it. And out of the two, surprisingly, even though I've probably got, you know, I find more flaws in this movie than Oppenheimer, I'd probably watch this more often than Oppenheimer, surprisingly.
Yeah.
There's great one-liners and, like, stuff that you would rewatch in this just for a laugh. Yeah.
If I wanted to, if I was less a bit drunk and I wanted to have, like, a laugh, I'd watch Barbie.
Yeah.
I probably wouldn't pop in Oppenheimer if I was just looking for a happy time. Serious time with the boys, I'd put on Oppenheimer. But this is, like, one of those movies where it's like, you're a bit buzzed. Let's just sit down and watch some, you know, Hot Pink.
But you don't need to pay attention the whole time. Like,
You
can have it on in the background. I would say for most, it's just going to be very funny. Like,
Yes.
And it's a Barbie movie. Like, come on. Like,
Always remember. Yeah. If you get too pulled into it, just remember what's on the cover of this thing.
If it's making you hate anyone, this movie, pull back. It's a Barbie movie, and think about yourself for a little bit.
All right. We can jump into spoilers quickly.
Yes.
So the point I was trying to make was, at the end, there's a point in the movie where the Kens take over the Barbie world, but then at the end they get it back. And then there's like a joke at the end, which was, it was funny, but at the same time I'm like, was that the point of this movie, where I think the Kens are like, oh, can we have a seat in the government or
Supreme
something?
Supreme Court,
yeah. Yeah, and then they're like, oh, no, you can have one of the backbench.
Yeah, two is enough for now.
Yeah.
I don't think it's – well, if you look at that scene, I don't think it's played that, oh, the Barbies are right here. It's like, oh, the Kens don't deserve a seat. It's just.
But I thought Margot Robbie's Barbie, I thought she learnt a lesson through her experiences in the real world.
But she didn't make that decision. She wasn't the one that said that.
Yeah.
It was the president.
It was the president.
But that comes to that point where the whole reason why they kind of chat, so Simu Liu's Ken.
Yeah.
And then the other Ken's like, oh, can we have, like, another Supreme Court justice, because make it fair, you know, there's 50-50 representation. They're like, you know, two's enough, we'll see how we go. Like, that's how they see it happening in the real world. Like, for some reason, we're not bringing more female justices up to the level. And I don't think it's for the reason they think it is. Like, I don't think we're not promoting more female justice just because they're women. I think it's because of the representation of people of that caliber at that stage. Like, how many women go into that level of judicial representation versus men if it's more women, yeah, I guess it should be representational. Obviously, it should be 50-50.
Yeah.
But the, yeah, like it's just those, I think they find it funny because it's like surrealism. That's like, well, you know, that's how they feel. If you're not represented in a group and you feel underrepresented, you're going to poke fun at the fact, like saying, oh, we're not represented because of who we are.
You know? I think it's once again probably a hyperbole thing as well.
Yeah.
I wouldn't take it any of it too seriously. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Like there are some parts where you can pull out and just go, okay. Like the one part where I found hilarious was when the Kens took over and the whole plan of the Barbies was to just like pretend you're interested. Just pretend you're interested in what they say. And this is like a typical girl thing sometimes when they actually do this in real life where they just say, just, you know, pretend like you give a shit. And they'll fall right into explaining their like their mansplaining kind of spiel. And one of them was like, "Oh, I can't wait to watch the 4-hour Snyder cut of Justice League."
Yeah.
I was just cracking laughing because I'm like, "You fucking nailed me to a tree! I'm so attacked right now! Yeah. Like, I want to watch that film."
Yeah, and I don't. This must be just a. It was extremely funny, but Ken's fascination with horses was just like,
yeah.
Like, where did that come from?
One of the funniest lines is at the end. It's like, when I found out the patriarchy wasn't about horses, I kind of didn't like it anyway.
Yeah. You know what I think it is? I think it's the idea that, so, you know, the whole cowboys and horses, it represents this kind of typical.
It's like this old American.
The old masculinity kind of thing. But from a feminist point of view, if you read some of the old works of old feminists, the way they kind of describe it is like the way men treat horses is the way they want to treat women. They want to break them, control them, and make sure that they're herded well and maintained and groomed. So it's like there's a what do you call an allegory that women kind of extend when they look at men who are obsessed with horses, and they're like, you know, that's kind of a red flag for them. So the way to introduce that mechanism is to say, oh yeah, Ken's obsessed with horses. Why? He doesn't say, but it's like, oh yeah, it's because maybe they're, you know, they make the guy look better, they make him look more macho, they can be controlled, they have to be broken from, you know, the wild untameness. So there's a lot of pre-existing history about that. But the fact that they chose to go with that was hilarious because they could have chosen cars, they could have chosen
I thought it would be like cars or more.
Like motorcycles or something.
Yeah.
And then when Ken comes back and he brings patriarchy, he's like, he's wearing the most ridiculous clothes.
Yeah.
He's got horses everywhere and he takes over the house and he calls it, he's like Mojo Dojo Casa House.
Yeah. Which is all just
which is
separate
just
all words just for house.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is like just a big man cave, right? And it's like, yeah. There's that one part though that it's like, he does all of this stuff, takes over Barbie's house, takes over the land and everything, and then has his own parties, and then he's like, doesn't feel so good, does it, when you're not included?
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, that's interesting. They actually brought a point where they showed his pain for a moment and why he did what he did. But it's never really addressed. Barbie just goes into a spiral and never extras, oh, I did something wrong maybe, or I was too obsessed. But they never addressed it again. So it's like, there's space to address stuff, but they didn't address it. Yeah. Which kind of goes back to the point where they could have actually had a moment of like, oh shit, maybe we shouldn't be doing this.
Yeah.
Just being in our own little world. But again, it's Barbie. So what do you expect? Ken is not the main product of this. So that's they even marketed like Barbie is everything. Ken is just Ken.
Yeah. I think, yeah, Barbie is the main protagonist of the story.
Yeah.
And they kind of leave it at the end that Ken still needs to
figure out who he is.
So like Barbie probably has more of an arc in this than Ken does. Ken's arc's incomplete at the end. Yeah.
Yeah. Because Ken wouldn't exist without Barbie, let's be honest.
Yes. At least that's kind of his problem through the whole thing is that he doesn't know what he is without Barbie. And then at the end he's like, I need to go figure that out, what I am without Barbie. Yeah.
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 So I think they obviously took that into a reasonable direction. And then the end of the film turning Barbie into an actual person. That was interesting. I wasn't expecting that. It felt like a bit of an Android 18 moment for me. Like they decided to make it's like the Pinocchio, like make the doll into the actual real person. So that was an interesting move. And the whole conversations that they brought in the actual creator of Barbie, I forgot her name. Like it was played by the actress who played Matilda's mother.
Yeah.
In Matilda.
Matilda.
Is it Matilda? Yeah, that's the movie name, right?
Matilda.
Matilda. Yeah. What did I say? Matilda's?
Matilda.
No, she said Matilda.
Did you say Matilda? Matilda.
I'm pretty sure
Matilda.
It said Matilda.
Matilda. Yeah. No, Yeah. No.
With an M.
Yes, sorry, with an M. Yeah. Played her mother. So, all those moments were really interesting where they brought the creator in and why she made the Barbie. And even, like, I think Neil deGrasse Tyson has something to say about the Barbie movie when he found out. It's like,
oh, okay. I'm sure he has something to say about Oppenheimer.
Oh, yeah. He had lots to say about Oppenheimer. But I think he talked about the social constructs that were introduced to us as children through dolls. So that beginning opening shot of Barbie is actually a whole reference to 2001 Space Odyssey, where they, you know, show like the girls playing with babies.
Yeah.
And that's kind of nurturing their so-called nurturing upbringing and telling girls what they need to do. But Barbie broke that in a way. But it broke it in a good way, I guess, but they never focused, like you said, on the negative aspects of consumerism, where they made Barbie like Malibu Barbie, you know, open house Barbie, Corvette Barbie. They just literally just told girls, don't worry about babies. Worry about, like, you know, buying handbags, matches, getting lipstick, getting your hats and dresses. And it was never addressed. The consumerism aspect was just like, this is cool. This is fine. Make more plastic, dump it into the atmosphere or the oceans. We don't care. Yeah. It's just like, I feel like they missed out on a whole conversation. Like you said, they could have had that. They didn't, because it probably would hurt their bottom line.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Will Ferrell was funny.
Yeah.
We talked about that. Yeah.
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 He was good.
He's funny.
He relieved a lot of stress from that film. It's just like every time he came in. Yeah. And he wasn't like a chauvinistic. It was like an ignorant CEO, but he wasn't chauvinistic.
Yeah.
It was interesting because that wouldn't have worked with Will Ferrell. You can never hate him.
Yeah. There's a couple of funny lines that he had.
Mm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think
I too many lines of this movie that are just hilarious to go through. Yeah.
It's like, oh, yeah, we care about women. We all love women. It's like a whole all-male board of executives. And it's like, my mother's a woman and I'm his son. It's like,
yeah.
Sometimes, that there were little moments where I'm like, okay, I've seen like a president say these exact lines to try and justify that he's got a balanced cabinet or something.
Mm. Recent presidents.
Recent presidents. Yeah. Yellow presidents. Sorry, orange, not yellow.
All right. Well, I give it a cognitive recalibration. I think we're all positive on this one.
It's better than The Flash.
Yeah, no. Yep. I reckon it is a must watch. You got to go watch it, you know, find out what it is for yourself and, yeah, again.
But also, I guess if you look at the marketing and you're like, I hate this, maybe don't go watch it.
If you're not remotely curious and if you're some dude like wrangling horses in the middle of Tennessee, and you know,
it's probably not for you.
Probably not for you. You might even be offended by this film and you want to do something afterwards. Like, just be careful.
Okay, moment of truth with the review. So I've got three sources.
Okay.
I've got Metacritic.
Aggregate. That's an aggregate kind of scoring.
Yeah, actually, I got four. So I got CinemaScore, which is the overall rating that people who watched the movie on opening night gave.
Yeah.
So we'll start with that one. And then I've got Metacritic, I've got Rotten Tomatoes, and I've got IMDb.
Nice.
So, and for background, you were saying, Taran was saying, that Barbie would score higher in terms of the critical scores, and Basque was saying Oppenheimer would be higher.
And I said, I don't care if it's official or fan ratings. That's what I remember saying that. Like, it can be either, which now I might be regretting.
So, CinemaScore, Barbie got an A, and Oppenheimer also got an A.
Ooh, close.
So, that's a draw there.
Draw. Okay. That's close.
Metacritic. So, Metascore for Barbie is 80, and for Oppenheimer, it's 88.
88. Oof. One
it's a high score.
It's pretty.
They're
good.
Both pretty high. Yeah,
it's pretty.
Yeah.
Both pretty high for Metacritic.
Yeah,
given that it takes in all the criticisms as well.
So that's a critic score for Metacritic. We'll look at the audience and the critics for Rotten Tomatoes. So the critics is 88% for Barbie.
Nice.
And for Oppenheimer, it is 93%.
Ooh, just edged.
Yeah. Both very high scores. Mm. So. Audience score, Barbie is 84% and Oppenheimer is
91. Audiences have been definitely very vocal about these two.
Yes.
Yeah. Both all very high scores for both of them. So
yeah,
both, I would say both very well received.
IMDb lastly. So we've got Barbie at 7.4 out of 10 and Oppenheimer is 8.6.
8.6.
So
edged out. IMDb is going to be the holdout for like all the Nolan fans, I'm guessing.
IMDb is also, I don't know how many like of the audience that probably like this movie go up onto IMDb and vote for it as well.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah. That is true. There's a bit of bias.
It's
there.
Probably more selection the audience bias. That hate it that would probably go at it.
Yeah.
And vote for it. So
yeah.
And does IMDb have a separation between critics and users? Or is it just one score?
Nah, it's just one score.
I think it's just one score.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, Metacritic does have a user score. So 5.1, interestingly, for Barbie.
Oof.
For which platform?
Metacritic.
That's probably strongly male dominant. Well, I'm maybe being like sexist here, but I think it's strongly male dominant on Metacritic.
Actually, I remember Metacritic's very famous for like video game reviews.
Games.
Yeah.
So it's got a lot of gamers. And if you know anything about gamers, it's very, very highly opinionated. So yeah, they're probably vocally
8.9.
Turfing this.
In terms of user score on Metacritic for Oppenheimer. So
yeah, interesting. Okay.
So Oppenheimer is the winner, but it was close.
It's close. It was close game.
It was close. And I know
Barbie fought valiantly.
Barbie fought valiantly. And we didn't put any sock eating condition on you if you lost. It was just on me because I was so confident. So, well played.
I'm glad you don't have to eat a sock.
I
don't know how we managed that.
There was a bit of hubris in there. I was a little bit too overconfident. Those margins of difference were definitely much tighter than I would have imagined it to be when I made that bet. So.
Yes. Yeah. But yeah, like you said, if we went by box office, then you would be eating a sock.
I'd be eating a couple.
Yeah.
I need to ask Remy for advice. Yeah. On how to chow down a sock. Yeah. No.
Cool. Thanks, Bosca, for joining us again. This was pleasure. a great episode to have you on.
Yeah. Paul. I don't think we'll get another situation again anytime soon. We got two films that are like this.
Yeah.
Released in the same window that are very, very different.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
So I think next week. It's a bit of a lull at the moment because of the writer's strike and movies getting pushed back, but we can talk about Secret Invasion if you've watched it.
No, I haven't.
I've seen the first few episodes.
Yeah. I think it's shit.
Yeah, it's not great. I think we'll need another episode just to dissect what's going on.
I'll watch the last episode. I'll watch the last episode because I heard it's horrifically bad, and I don't think much happens until then anyway.
What is the main criticism? Is it just pace?
And stupid shit.
It's just so inconsequential. Like it's this consequence, but it feels like it's slow. And there's so many filler episodes, and the end is just like it's just like what are you doing? The end was just like what are you doing?
I know what happens at the end, and it's horrifically bad.
Is it like at all close to the comics?
No, this is not Secret Invasion to the comics.
Because Secret Invasion in the comics is quite a big arc in the comics, and all the superheroes are involved in it because Skrulls start becoming superheroes, they start imitating superheroes.
Yeah, I've heard about this, yeah.
Whereas in this, there's no other Marvel heroes in it. It's just Nick Fury, essentially.
Hmm.
So I think that's where they missed a trick because it doesn't feel as impactful without the – I mean, they did something else separate to that, which was just not as good.
But
we can talk about it, I guess, in another episode.
I've seen the first couple of episodes, and it brought me back to that slight feeling of dread in the beginning of Captain Marvel when you start, halfway through Captain Marvel, where it starts to reveal, oh, there's a lot of Skrulls on Earth. There can be anyone, you know, that can infiltrate.
Yeah.
That feeling of like, wow, there really is no telling who is who.
Yeah.
That they brought that back, and then there was a pretty significant character death in one of the first few episodes, and I was like, damn, this is starting off interestingly, but it is slowing down already from episode 2 and onwards, so I was just like, wow.
Well, interesting, coming back to bring this back to Barbie, the main antagonist in Secret Invasion is one of the Kens in Barbie.
He is one of the Kens, yes. Yeah. That's right. Damn, they picked out all the good actors. Nice.
Cool. And we'll see what else comes out after that. I think, Blue Beetle might be our next big movie release that we talk about.
Yeah. I think it's going to slow down a little bit from here onwards, but there's a lot of other stuff coming.
There is The Nun too, though.
Yes. Getting back into The Nun. Karen, you're in? We have to get Abhishek.
Abhishek, yeah.
Sorry, I have to get Abhishek. We have to sit him down. He's going to have job scares again. Oh, man.
Yeah, and I think it's really just June 2, I think, which is the major, which might actually get pushed as well because of the strike. So if that does get pushed, then I think it's going to, even if it doesn't, I think it's highly unlikely that anything's going to make more than Barbie this year. Yeah.
It'll be tough. I mean, look, even those the sequels always don't do as well as the first ones unless you're a really strong franchise. So we'll see how this goes.
Yeah. But yeah, I think we'll do better than the first one just because the first one came out during COVID. So
oh, true. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it'll definitely do better. And that film has garnered a lot of fans over the last couple of years because not many people had the opportunity to watch it.
And it's going to fill the Star Wars void as well.
Yeah, yeah.
There's originally like a Christmas Star Wars movie. This is going to replace that.
Yeah, yeah. I think that brings us to the end because my dog is asking us to come out now. So I think
we've got the alarm bells. Yeah. So hurry up.
So thanks everyone for listening. Hope you enjoyed this episode. Let us know if you've had, if you've got any thoughts on Barbie or Oppenheimer. You can do that through various forms. So Instagram,
Facebook, all social media, or cognitive recalibration at gmail.com.
Yeah. Cognitive Recalibration Podcast.
At gmail.com. That's right. Yeah.
And if you want to support the podcast, obviously subscribe to the channel on YouTube. Give us a review on Spotify or iTunes because that makes us more discoverable on search engines. And keep telling your friends about the podcast if they don't listen to us.
Yep. Brilliant.
Great.
Okay.
Thanks, everyone. And we'll see you in another episode.
So, yeah, have a good one.
See ya.
Bye.
Take care.